Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second week of our hymn adventure. If you weren't here last week, there are a few handouts in the back that Ted has, and he also put them up as a PDF on the website along with the recording. So if you'd like to catch up on the hymns that were popular back in the 40s at Westminster and that we still sing, it's kind of an amazing list. Today's topic is early
from Puritans to revivals. And I plan to go through the history and then have question time. But if you have any questions or don't understand something, feel free to interrupt. That's totally fine. During the hour, when we get to the time of the American Revolution, we'll talk about America's first dominant composer of church music, William. So I think it's fitting that we sing one of his tunes for our opening prayer. It's number 651 in your hymnal. You'll grab a hymnal pen and turn to 651. I waited patiently for God. The text is a setting of Psalm 40 from the Island Community in Scotland. The tune by Billings is not familiar to us. It wasn't familiar to Jim or to me, so we both learned it. But it's lovely and not hard to sing. Jim will play it all the way through and we'll sing verses 1 and 4. Just 1 and 4.
The result was the Bay Psalm Book. First book
they didn't endure in our hymnody. The book had no tunes, but recommended well-known tunes, including some from the Geneva Psalter. The most famous example of this is Old Hundred. In English, it's a setting of Psalm 100, "All people that on earth do dwell," and we still sing it. And of course, we sing the tune as our doxology every Sunday after the offering. And I do have a fun fact about this book. One of 11 known surviving copies of the first edition of an A Psalm book sold at auction in 2013 for $14.2 million. This was a record for a printed book, and especially one that the text words are great. This and other psalters were used by the Puritans and others in the Reformed tradition of John Calvin. In New England, these Christians became Congregationalists. In other colonies, Presbyterians. I'll pass around my great-grandmother's psalmbook. It is from much later. She was born during the Civil War. It has her name on the back of it. The size is a little bit smaller than the base psalmbook, and it also has hymns after the psalms, but you kind of get the point how it is with just text. No music, but you'll notice a meter listed for each text. Either the number of syllables per line or letters such as LM for long meter, referring to a tune in long meter. Old Hundred would fit that meter. Now we'll move into the 1700s, still colonial era. Change was in the air. In England, musical style changed and the singing of songs evolved. New song versions were written, and they found their way to America, where they were embraced, and hymns were added gradually. It's worth noting that communication and travel to and from England and Scotland was common, much more than we might think, considering how difficult travel was back then. Yet it was even harder for settlers to break their ties with their motherland. Indeed, there was more communication between the colonies and Britain than among the colonies themselves. The colonists were, in that sense, insular, each colony defending its turf. So it's not surprising that England continued to strongly influence religion in America throughout the 18th century, even through war with England. The most famous of these new psalm and hymn writers was Isaac Watts, known as the father of English hymnody and author of Joy to the World. A nonconformist minister, as if not Church of England, he wrote in the first half of the 18th century. His text included Christianized paraphrases of psalms as well as hymns. He's credited with some 750 texts. His religious opinions were more non-denominational than is common for a nonconformist. He was more interested in promoting education and spreading the faith. His purpose was evangelical. It follows that his work was influential among religious revivalists of the 18th century. 12 of his texts are in our hymnal. They are, of course, some of his most famous. The list is on the second page of your handout, the back of the first page. "When I survey the wondrous cross, come Holy Spirit, heavenly dove, Jesus shall reign where ere the sun. I sing the mighty power of God," and the list goes on. I would guess that you recognize almost all of them, if not all. The familiar "Our God, Our Help in Ages Past," which is number 687, if you want to look at it, illustrates a typical Watts text set to a contemporary with it, St. Anne. And you'll hear this as the postlude this morning. The text is a paraphrase of Psalm 90 and the original. our God, not O God. The latter paving both for a while in the 20th century, but that's past. Our God reflects the essence of corporate worship. We worship God together as the body of Christ. It's in common to seek them, which is truly a common meter used for many ends, including Amazing Grace and Over a Thousand Tongues. You'll hear four lines, 8, 6, 8, 6. The tune is a type called a plain tune. Such tunes were ubiquitous in this early period. There is a dignity to many of these plain tunes that I find moving. Power in elegant simplicity. The St. Anne melody is angular, with lots of skips, and yet it still flows. Da, 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 da. You know, it just goes. And I frankly find it beautiful. And listen for this if you haven't been to church yet, and you'll hear it in Osteen. Another example of this type of noble tune in common meter is the Scottish Dundee from 1615. I've always associated this tune with the Presbyterian Church. I grew up seeing it, To God Moves in a Mysterious Way, a beautiful text from 1773 by William Cowper, but spelled like Cowper. It was the last hymn text he wrote following his attempted suicide. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Who recognizes this hymn? Did any of you sing it growing up? Yeah, this was a big one in my church. Cooper was good friends with John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace. They both worked for the abolition of slavery. In our hymnal, Cooper's words are changed to, O God, in a mysterious way, great wonders to perform, you plant your footsteps in the sea and ride upon the storm. I think they're getting rid of male pronouns. This title, the first line, is hard for me to remember. So if you want to search for it, just search for the tune by name, Dundee. Dundee is also paired with a paraphrase of Psalm 121, I to the hills will lift my eyes, from 1909. It's number 45, and if you'll turn to that, we'll sing together the first verse. I'll play it once, and just to get a sense of it, and like our God, our hope in ages past, I think it makes a beautiful funeral hymn that everyone can sing.
The 18th century also
published in 1708 in England, we sing it to Jesus Christ who's risen today every Easter. The Alleluias are decorated, so it's certainly not plain. From later in the century comes Lockingham, also English. It's an earlier tune for when I survey the wondrous cross. It's dignified, but flowing, with more than one note on a syllable to propel it. It's not plain, just as our opening hymn wasn't plain. I'll play it for you, so you'll get a sense and see if you recognize it.
Churches, in the open air, in halls, large
Chosen hymn texts often appeal to the emotions. Metrical psalms and the hymns of Watts and his contemporaries held their popularity, but simple, lively tunes and words would begin to win the day. A good example is All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name, set to the oldest American hymn tune in continuous use since it was first published in 1793. And written for this English text. And this is the tune we sing today to All Hail the Power. At all meetings, the ultimate goal of singing and preaching was conversion. A specific conversion experience was the ticket to salvation. Both talk and song appealed to the emotions of sinful souls, encouraging them to change. The songs reinforce the message. For the already saved souls, the songs help them affirm their commitment to Jesus. By the early 1740s in New England, for example, there was a greater interest in religious experience, widespread emotional preaching, and intense emotional actions accompanying conversion, including fainting and weeping. Also, there was a greater emphasis on prayer and devotional reading, and new members increased. The evangelistic influence of the revivals was long-lasting. It set Protestant America on a new course, and most Protestants joined the movement. Presbyterians definitely included. We can't talk about hymns and revival in the 18th century without a focus on the Wesleys. Who here has ever been a Methodist? That's good. Okay, yeah, this is your turn. In England, the brothers John and Charles Wesley were Oxford-educated Anglican clerics whose lives spanned most of the 1700s. They managed to make remarkable strides in reviving religious passion when English churches were becoming apathetic and the American colonies were growing and ripe for new ideas. While they never left the Church of England, they worked as evangelists to establish a new brand of heartfelt religion. It was named Methodism because of the methodical way the Wesleys carried out their Christian faith, focused on the pursuit of biblical holiness. Also, both men experienced conversion separately in 1738, and they endorsed but didn't require similar experiences for their followers. John excelled as a preacher and compiler and editor of hymn collections. He wasn't a musician, but he had strong ideas about good music, and he had good musical taste. At least he thought so. Above all, he believed that singing, quote, should be a heartfelt and spontaneous act of worship by the people, end quote. His collections contain texts from a variety of sources, including some he translated from German. He favored tunes that reflected the current style in secular music at the dawning of the classical era. A supremely confident man, John Wesley assumed that if he thought a hymn was excellent, all his followers would John's brother Charles excelled at writing poetry for hymn texts. We still sing many of Charles Wesley's hymns today. The 12 in our current hymnal are listed on page 2 of your handout. Thank him for
heartily. However, John did not approve of organs in the church. Charles, on the other hand, was open. The Church of England did approve of organs. I thought that was just kind of interesting, and to be so in love with good music that John didn't like organs in church. That just disappointed me very much. Both John and Charles traveled to the American colony of Georgia. You know the rest of the story. Those famously the circuit riders that covered the frontier, and many Methodist churches that still scattered the rural countryside. In urban areas, the Methodist church also flourished, but in a more sophisticated form. The urban-rural divide is, as you might expect, reflected in the music Methodists sang. Also, the 19th century brought a new kind of congregational song that proved widely popular. It was definitely less formal. And we'll talk about it next week, but let's just say that from his grave, John Wesley would not approve. He was something of a snob. And I think that really is confirmed by a lot of people that he was a snob. So that sort of disappointed me too. But back to the late 18th century. As part of the new religious zeal, colonists put energy into improving congregational singing, adding vitality. Part of this effort included musical education. Singing schools developed, mostly in the Northeast, led by traveling music teachers. The music instruction was basic at best, but the results were at least spirited. All this took place in the years before the Revolution and just after. The leading figure coming out of the singing schools was America's first recognized composer, William Billings, whom we met with our opening prayer. We have two of his tunes in our hymnal, When Jesus Wept, which has been known for a long time, and Lewistown, which is paired with two fairly recent texts, and one we just said. Number 194 in the hymnal, if you want to refer to it, When Jesus Wept, is not a typical hymn. It's a canon around. You see just the notes of the melody, and you would sing it like row, row, row your boat. Both text and tune come from 1770 in Boston, where agitation for independence was strong. The text refers to that brief Bible verse, John 11:35, Jesus wept. This is part of the Lazarus story, and verse 38 refers to Jesus groaning in the King James Version. Jesus also wept over the city of Jerusalem, lamenting its future. This is in Luke 19. The author, Perez Morton, was a Boston lawyer and revolutionary patriot who surely knew his Bible. The text reads, When Jesus wept, the falling tear in mercy flowed beyond all bound. When Jesus groaned, a trembling fear seized all the guilty world around. The haunting tune seems perfect for this text. When Jesus wept became probably Billy's best known work. So we'll listen to it, sung as around.
See?
What a thoughtless wretch was I, to mourn and murmur and repine, to see the wicked placed on high, in pride and robes of honor shine. Oh, their end, their dreadful end! My sanctuary taught me so. On slippery rocks I see them stand, and fiery billows roll below.
Emotions were heightened. Think, weeping, groaning, Revivals following this model lasted for decades. Your handout includes an excellent article that describes the Cambridge campaign and includes some choice quotes from eyewitnesses. The writer is Peter Smith, currently religion editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, formerly a religion reporter in Louisville, Kentucky. The article is part of the 200th anniversary celebration of its most famous camp meeting. I think you'll enjoy reading it. Peter is a very good writer, and he's done a couple of seminars for us here. And I think he'll be glad that we're passing this out. Camp meetings were uniquely suited to bringing masses of people to faith. Why? They were primarily rural, with space for all comers. Singing was central to supporting the preaching, and there was lots of singing. The music came largely from oral traditions of cultures with varied origins, African, Scottish, English, and their American permutations. This yielded opportunity for both Black and white Americans to overhear each other's music. The singing was vigorous, the mood was electric. A kind of melody, dance, and song energized the flocks. The songs reinforced the message of conversion in almost irresistible ways. They spoke to feelings, to emotions, and they were convincing. Since this was at first a largely oral tradition, at revivals, the people needed to catch both the melodies and the text, and leave these tunes ringing in their heads. One of those tunes we sing to the battle hymn of the Republic. The melody is popular at camp meetings, used with a variety of texts, all before it was put to John Brown's body by his older in the grave, and then the battle hymn. African Americans were drawn to the emotional pageantry of the meetings, and many were converted to Christianity, although many also continued to practice or at least respect the spirituality of their native cultures. This was an exciting time for religion in the young United States. Numerous song collections were printed that included songs noted from the oral . Many of these collections were in shape note notation, rather than the round notes we know, the shapes of triangles and squares. This was a method of teaching people to read music. Going around are examples of shape note music. The tune is usually in the tenor, and I've highlighted that, so most of these are familiar tunes. The most famous collection is Sacred Heart. It was in a format like this. And this is what your examples come from. So it sort of looks just like your examples. And it's still in print. And people still sing shape music. They have gatherings. There's even a society in Pittsburgh that does it. It's really quite a lot of fun. Many others were also published, mostly in rural parts of the country. One famous one was called Southern Harmony, published in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And we would have picked it, it's so amazing. If you look it up in our memory, we have quite a few hymns from it. We'll listen to a shade note piece that was first printed in Maine, rural Maine, but was found in an earlier manuscript in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Do you notice the key thing is Pennsylvania didn't come again? I think they were very, very It's called Star in the East. Verse 1 is anonymous, but 2 and 3 come from England, written by an Anglican bishop. Once again, the British presence. But you just kind of wouldn't think that something like an Anglican bishop would fit so well with this rustic tradition, but it did. Let's listen to it.
Hail, my best poems to the grave, the heavy door down. shine where our infantry dealer was laid. Cold on his cradle, the dewdrops are shining. Low lies his bed with the beasts of the storm. Angels adore him in slumbers reclining. Wise men and shepherds before him do fall. Brightest and best of the sons of the morning, dawn on our darkness and lend us thy days. Star in the east, the horizon adorning, guide where our infant Redeemer was laid.
And I'll warn you.
What did you think of that? did like.
No.
Yes.
It makes sense to me.
It did.
When you think, usually we sing it now, it's kind of dirty.
Exactly.
But it should be very uplifting.
It should be. And then in that sense, that tune Arlington from last week, well, no wonder people send this text to that. Bart?
I was going to say something, but it's interesting listening to it. It's like getting into a time machine, stepping back to the period that the song was written in.
Yeah.
Congregation made up of church professionals. It's always inspiring. they just let it go and they sing.
Yeah.
And you just really feel, you know, it's not a revivalist sort of feeling, but it sure is everybody's heart out there in it.
Yeah. And it's true worship. They're singing it worshipfully.
Right.
Yeah. I agree. I feel the same way. That kind of keeps me going when I have to come back and see the regular Presbyterian congregation. And anything else? Yes, John.
Yeah, I have the Shape Notes recording. It reminded me of earlier music, for example, Renaissance music, where you have parts. Mm-hmm. They would get together with some parts, which is usually secular music, right?
No, it's sacred
too. Well, my coming up to the question, is there any secular music in America, in some sense, parallel to the hymns? Let's say in the Puritan period or after, it seems like everything's religious.
Yeah, and in the Puritan period, I think it pretty much was, but after, when you get to Billings time, and the Revolutionary War was on the horizon, there were lots of patriotic
songs written.
And that's where you get some of the secular. I think they sang the sacred music in their secular gatherings, too, because it was just
they're part of. Get a few more secular pieces. And they
were in that same kind of imitative style
called the fusions. They weren't really
very
crude, but
the
singing music society started out, and the idea of education and the societies. And so Boston and New York, then you had big
singing societies
that started oratorios, or at least choruses from oratorios. So
that developed slowly.
I was thinking kind of the same thing. We have one foot in the culture and one foot in the church, and the two are in sort of a conflict in a way. So is there a way that
I didn't want to ask that, it's too complex.
It's complex, but I think you have a point. And especially because some of the hymns of the church have become part of popular culture, such as Amazing Grace. And I guess what I'll have to say, and it's true, the revival thing went on all the way through the Billy Graham.
And then on. But it felt
popular in the U.S. It wasn't really popular, but it was popular in England. And then Billy Graham crusade got a hold of it, and
it got
really popular in the mid to
later
20th century.
So
it wasn't a hymn I
heard it.
But it appeared
in the 1990 hymnal and is in our current hymnal.
God and glory. And
so I think all that kind of got in. Popular culture a bit. Yeah.
So two examples are kind of interesting here. It's Sacred Head, which is a secular thing. Some people kind of also call it a drinking tool. And then that became a hymn and a chorale. And then in America it crept out into popular music with Paul Simon making it an American tune.
Yeah. It was American, it's German.
Yeah, so Sacred Head. So, you know, that Paul Simon used that tune for an American tune talking about, you know, late 60s sort of a reflection on the time that we're living through in the late 60s. And Peter Paul and Mary had a song that they recorded called Because All Men Are Brothers.
And if you stay out, we would play it for you.
Right. But then you also have Morning Is Broken, which was never a terribly popular tune until Cat Stevens sang it, and
And I think that's all the time.